My name's Ross Patterson. I live in New Zealand. I've been researching these discoveries seriously ever since I met Jonathan Gray, which would have been in the early 90s, around about 1990, 1991. I was working at a Christian book ministry in the South Island of New Zealand. And I was tasked with organizing a speaking tour for Jonathan Gray. And what he was sharing, what he was speaking on, was the discovery of Noah's Ark, discovery of Sodom and Gomorrah, the discovery of the Red Sea crossing site, the discovery of Mount Sinai in Arabia, and the Ark of the Covenant. And when I reviewed the material, I'd had heard of the Ark of the Covenant discovery some years before by a guy called Ron Wyatt, but I hadn't taken it too seriously. But when I was shown Jonathan Gray's newsletters that he was publishing at the time, it gave a lot more detail. And as I went through the material and was thinking about a itinerary for Jonathan Gray, I was thinking, wow, this stuff is either a very elaborate hoax or they've actually got something here, because it was documenting, here's the site, for example, of Sodom and Gomorrah, here's the site of Noah's Ark, here's pictures of it, here's how you get to it. For example, at Noah's Ark, there was pictures of the visitor center, which the government had built only a matter of years before. So I was thinking, this is either quite an elaborate hoax, or they're actually reporting something which we're not hearing in the mainstream media so much. And so I started researching separately just to see, does it stack up? And everything I could check out agreed with what was in this newsletter. So as I took Jonathan around New Zealand and heard him speak each night, it was quite eye-opening, shall I say. We had large crowds of people come. He got radio interviews. We had, in some meetings, overflowing people standing at the back of the halls. You could see the interest in the public with these things.
So, what year are we talking about, Ross?
This is about 1991, from memory, 92, somewhere around there. Last century, I suppose, if you think about
Yeah,
it.
that's right. Well, look, I mean, it's interesting because I can remember back in the 1970s a bit of a hoo-ha, even on the television, over, I guess it's Ron Wyatt and his belief that he had discovered Noah's Ark. I mean, in fact, there were headlines in the newspapers. It looks like Noah's Ark may have been discovered, blah blah, 1970s. So, how was what Jonathan was doing related to what Ron Wyatt had been up to, the American? And am I right in thinking Jonathan was from Australia originally?
I understand he was born in New Zealand, but he was working in Australia when he heard about Ron Wyatt's claims. And the story that Jonathan tells is he got shown Ron Wyatt's materials and set out to disprove them. This is the story that he tells. And he went to meet Ron Wyatt with a briefcase, he says, full of objections, and went through them with Ron Wyatt. And by the end of his interview, discussion, call it what you want, he was a convert, if you want to call him that. Then he made his own trips to the Middle East. He made a trip to Turkey to visit the site. And in his meetings, he'd show slides of his trip to Dogu Bayazit and the areas over there. Like he'd show photographs of the bullet holes and shop windows, because as you know, it's a fairly unstable area. Well, it was at the time in the 90s, particularly. It's much easier to go there now, much safer. But back in the 90s, that was kind of the peak. The 80s and 90s was the peak of the uprising. There's an independent, a separatist movement run by the PKK. Have you heard of the PKK guerrillas? They've been fighting for independence, an independent Turkish, Kurdish homeland.
Well, that's right. This Kurdistan is kind of divided up, isn't it, between, I believe it's Turkey and Iraq and Syria. In fact, I can remember 1990 when we were actually reporting at the BBC about the first Gulf War. One of the first things they said is, oh, there's a great opportunity here to, you know, push Saddam Hussein around a little bit and force him to give a bit of land to the Kurds, you know, because they've been fighting for their own country for decades. And so, yeah, this is an interesting zone. And it was also fascinating that as Ron Wyatt had believed he'd discovered the Ark there, so hostilities broke out and it became a very, very dangerous, extremely difficult place to get to.
Yes, exactly. And it was during the Gulf War that the Kurds, I guess, were told, you know, here's an opportunity to carve out a piece of Iraq. And we know from history, Saddam Hussein gassed a lot of the Kurds, you know, using chemical weapons. Very sad. And so this independence war continued because the Kurds live in a large portion of Turkey and Syria, as you mentioned, and in Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, of course, and also some of them are in Iran, and they would love to have their own homeland. But of course, these countries don't have any desire to carve off large portions of their nation to give to another group, because there's a lot of this area has a lot of oil in it too.
But it was called Surprising Discoveries, which I love. It's very understated. And if you actually sit and watch one of these films, like Noah's Ark Discovered by Jonathan Gray, and there is a YouTube channel, the Third Watch Ministry, you can pick up a lot of these films on. It's essentially what he's done. He went up there and he actually began filming, first of all, his attempts to get to that part of the mountain where there are these Noah's Ark-like ruins. I mean, can you just describe what he found when he went up the mountain, when he finally managed to get there?
Yes, what you find when you go there, it's near a village called Uzungeli. If you travel from the nearest large city is a place called Dogubayazid. And if you travel from there, there's a highway that goes past Dogubayazid, through Dogubayazid towards Iran. It's one of the entry points from Turkey to Iran. And about 20 kilometers from the border, there's a sign, a road sign on the side of the road. It says Noah's Ark, or it's in Turkish, Nuhun Gemisi, 5 kilometres up the road. And if you go up that road there, you come to the site, which looks like a boat shape in the ground, this outline that's very distinct. There's nothing like it around. When you measure the site, and we've done this a number of ways with tape measures, we've used GPS, using the calculation between two points on a sphere, you find that it is exactly the 300 biblical cubits as mentioned in the Bible. Just by the way, there's actually two different cubits mentioned in the Bible. There's an older one, which is often referred to today as the Royal Egyptian cubit. And using that one, it's exactly the right length. And so this is the site that Jonathan Gray was sharing, along with his experiences of traveling in that area at that time. It was much more like the Wild West, quite lawless, shall we say, back in the 80s and 90s. In fact, there was one time when Ron White was researching the site where Kurdish guerrillas came along and the army commandos who were protecting them shot and killed 6 of them. So another time, Ron White got kidnapped by some of these guerrillas and held prisoner for 3 weeks. So it was back in those days when Jonathan went there, it was quite risky. And he told some of his adventures. In fact, he even talked about how before he left Australia to go there, he approached some Kurdish community in Australia, and they gave him a Kurdistan, I think it was, passport or visa, you know, so that if he did have any trouble with the Kurds, he could say, look, I've got an official Kurdish visa, even though that wasn't, official Turkish documentation. So that's how it was back in the early 90s when Jonathan Gray first visited there.
I mean, I think the film stands for itself. If people are interested, do have a look. Noah's Ark Discovered by Jonathan Gray. It's, yeah, he does, I think, a pretty good job in pulling together some of the links between this specific place in this war zone as it was then and evidence there in the Bible. What about Sodom and Gomorrah? These are two cities which are kind of relevant today when we look at the slide of morality down the sewers, really, and you know, the idea that morality is sort of uncool and people just don't want to, they want to do what they want rather than keep up these moral standards. And that's what those old cities were about, wasn't it? It was about debauchery and this kind of thing. So maybe you can just explain what, you know, got Jonathan interested in finding these. Is this again linked to Ron Wyatt and what he found?
Yes. Okay. Yes, very much. Again, this is another, some of the research that Ron Wyatt did that Jonathan followed up and helped publicize. And we're extremely grateful for Jonathan for publicizing this in Australia and New Zealand. That's how I learned about these things. What happened was Ron Wyatt was researching where the Red Sea crossing was and would travel down from Jerusalem down towards Eilat on the Gulf of Aqaba many times. And as he went past these ruins, one day it suddenly struck him. If you look closely, they don't look quite natural. So he went and investigated. This was during the 80s. And so Ron shared this idea. Look, here's these sites. And if you look on them, you find these balls of sulfur embedded in these strange shapes made of this white material, this ashy material. And so Jonathan did his own expedition there, of course, when he heard about these and documented finding these sulfur balls. What Jonathan would do in his meetings is he would actually bring along samples of these balls of sulfur, and he would light one in the meeting. That impressed people quite a lot because you could smell the burning sulfur. They're so pure, you can pluck them out of these ashen shapes near the Dead Sea and put a match to them and they burn just like that. You don't have to add anything to get them going. So I got one of these balls from Jonathan. I took it to a lab myself in New Zealand. We had it analyzed and it was 98.4% pure sulfur with a few other trace minerals in it. I had magnesium in it as well. So quite unique. There's nothing
it. That doesn't on its own prove anything, surely. I mean, that could just be a random sulfur deposit there.
Well, here's the thing. Sulfur, as you find in nature, and this is very significant. Sulfur has two forms. Normally, in nature, you find it in what they call rhombic. The molecules are the crystals, if you like. The molecules of sulfur are it's like a ring of eight atoms. Eight sulfur atoms form a ring, and that's the sulfur molecule. They call it rhombic, and it's that yellow, classic yellow color. But the sulfur found at these sites is what they call monoclinic, where the molecules are broken down into individual atoms. That's why, hence, monoclinic sulfur. And you don't find that in nature because monoclinic sulfur naturally goes back to this rhombic form. Like if you go to a geothermal area, you'll find sulfur crystals or sulfur deposits. It's always this yellow color. But these sulfur balls it's like chalk. It's like compressed powder with this magnesium in it. It's quite unique. And there's not been any other samples like that found anywhere else in the world. And the thing is, they're embedded in these geometric shapes and what consist of basically ash. If you analyze the material that these sulfur balls are sitting in, which have these geometric shapes, it's essentially limestone that's been burnt with sulfur. Because, you know, ancient cities were built of limestone. Limestone's easy to quarry. There's a lot of limestone in that area. Like the walls of Jerusalem, if you visit the city of Jerusalem today, the walls are made of limestone blocks. So if you burn limestone with sulfur, you end up with this essentially calcium sulfate ash. And so these balls of brimstone are embedded in these these ruined structures of calcium sulfate ash, which is exactly what you'd expect to have left behind if cities built of limestone were incinerated with sulfur or brimstone, as the Bible calls it. So it's exactly what you'd expect to find.
And what about is there anything else to link these specific locations and anything left there, if there is anything left, to these two ancient cities in the Bible?
Yes, if you go through the story in the Bible, and it describes where these took place, down in the Vale of Siddim, near the Vale of Siddim, and the Jordan Valley. It used to be a very lush and fertile area, according to the Bible. When Abraham and his nephew Lot moved there, it describes it as being like, it says, the garden of the Lord. It's here in Genesis chapter 13 and verse 10. This is back in the days of Abraham and Lot. And the backstory was they decided to separate because obviously God was blessing them. Their flocks and herds were multiplying. And so Abraham said, look, if you choose to go one way, I'll go the other. He didn't want any strife, it says. And it says in Genesis 13, verse 10, Lot lifted up his eyes and beheld all the plain of Jordan that was well watered everywhere, before the Lord destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. And it says, even as the garden of the Lord. And the garden of the Lord, of course, is the Garden of Eden. So this is saying, before Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, that whole plain of Jordan was like the Garden of Eden. And you know, that's been confirmed through archaeology. Over in Jordan, they've discovered large cemeteries across from where these sites are that Ron White and Jonathan Gray were investigating. And they've estimated there's about five of these cemeteries. These date way back. These are the ancient Canaanites that were buried there. And the number of graves is just mind-boggling. They've excavated three of them, and they've estimated in the three that they've excavated, about 500,000 individuals were buried there. And there's another couple they haven't even touched yet. So it's looking like there's easily could be 1.5 to 2 million people buried in these cemeteries. Now, to have cemeteries of that size, you would have to have very big cities nearby. And of course, what do we find in history? Can you think of any large cities that were in the Jordan Valley? And of course, Sodom and Gomorrah. There's nothing there now. It's a desert. It's a very barren, bleak area today. So these cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were huge. You know, we talk about disasters of biblical proportions. It really was. These were massive cities living in this beautiful, well-watered area. And what's interesting, in these graves that they've been excavating in Jordan, they find the people were buried with jars of food for the afterlife. You know how a lot of ancient cultures would send the dead on their way with things for the afterlife. And when they've investigated what food was buried with these people, they find a huge range of products: watermelons, peaches, apricots, pomegranates, you know, wheat, dates, plums, barley, a whole range of stuff, which shows it was a very fertile, very lush area. But of course, if you go there today, it's actually quite barren, except around the Jordan River where they irrigate.
Well, that's amazing, absolutely amazing, really. And also, I mean, I think you've done a pretty good job, a bit like Jonathan was trying to do with Ron Wyatt, with me. You know, I'm asking you for a bit more evidence, and of course, the evidence is there. You've got it. Again, so that film, that particular film, is called The Lost Cities of Sodom and Gomorrah by Jonathan Gray. Once again, very understated title called Surprising Discoveries. I would say mind-blowing in a way. But, I mean, you mentioned briefly there something about the Red Sea crossing, because I understand this is where the Red Sea parted to enable the Jews and Moses to get away from Egypt. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. This is another one of those amazing stories in the Bible, which people read and think, well, that's a lovely fairy tale. But, you know, it's not written in the Bible as a parable or an analogy. It's written as history. And if you go through the clues given in the Bible, work out what would the Exodus route be, where does it take you to? Now, there is a traditional Mount Sinai, which, you know, for years and years, tourists have gone there. There's a monastery there called St. Catherine's Monastery. However, if you take that as the mountain they went to where the Ten Commandments was given and work back from that, you end up with a crossing through the Gulf of Suez, and nothing's ever been found there. You have lots of question marks. Where were these points along the way before they came to Mount Sinai? And you look at the maps and back of a lot of Bibles, they've got question marks on the place names. Whereas Ron did some research, and of course Jonathan followed up with this. Jonathan did his own dive trip to the Red Sea when he heard about the location. He hired some divers from Israel, and they went down and checked this location out. And it makes perfect sense. It's a place not in the Gulf of Suez, but on the other side of the peninsula in the Gulf of Aqaba. And what's fantastic about this location is two things. If you look at the whole of the Exodus route as described in the Bible, not only where they traveled to the Red Sea, but the mountain they came to after they crossed the Red Sea, there's a fantastic candidate for that in Saudi Arabia. And interesting, the Bible itself says Mount Sinai in Arabia. And so the whole picture works. You've got the Exodus from Egypt. They traveled for a number of days through the desert. They came to this place where the Bible says Pharaoh would say they're entangled in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. So they were trapped in this rugged area. They're on a beach with the water in front of them, Pharaoh's army coming behind. Then they had to cross through the Red Sea along the seabed. So you had to have a seabed that was, you could walk on it if the water was taken away. You cross that, you come to an area where the other events of the Exodus took place, like the bitter waters of Marah, a place called Elim, and then they came to Mount Sinai. And this place in the Gulf of Aqaba fits right into that storyline perfectly. And then the icing on the cake is if you dive at this location, and if you look in the right places, you find the traces of Egyptian chariots. Now, just to clarify that, it's been a long time since the Exodus. You know, it's been 3,500 years. That's a long time. So you're not looking for a museum on the bottom of the Red Sea. You know, wooden chariots don't last that long. But you find in the coral shapes, like round shapes, wheel shapes. You find chariot cab shapes. Where the coral grew on the chariots when they were drowned in the Red Sea, and even though the wood disappeared after a time, the coral retained the shape. And you can see these. And we've taken metal detectors down, and you can detect metal inside these shapes. Now, I'll be honest, they're not easy to find. We've gone on trips and searched and found nothing. Other trips we've gone and we've found a beautiful round shape with metal in it, you know, because the Egyptian chariots, while they were made of wood, they had metal fittings, like the hubs of the chariots, where the wheels turned on the axles, they were made of bronze or brass. Where the spokes attached to the rim, they had metal fittings. And you can detect the traces of these metal still in the coral. So it's the discovery of this place was, first of all, looking at the Exodus route and saying, okay, where's the most logical place for them to cross the Red Sea to get to Mount Sinai in Arabia? And the evidence found in Mount Sinai is fantastic. The real Mount Sinai in Arabia. It's a place called Jebel El-Lawz. And what they've found there is amazing. The carvings on the rock, they show there's this altar at this mountain with Egyptian apis bulls carved on it. and there's an encampment. They found a cemetery there of thousands of individuals. And we know from the Bible story that thousands of people were killed at Mount Sinai when during the apostasy of the Golden Calf incident. If these things had been found at the traditional Mount Sinai, they'd say, there you go, there's the proof. What more proof do you need that this traditional mountain is the real one? But the evidence being found is not in the Sinai Peninsula, at the traditional Mount Sinai. It's being found at this mountain, Jebel El-Oz in Saudi Arabia. So the whole picture works really well. And these were the sites, the Red Sea Crossing and Mount Sinai, that Jonathan Gray and Ron Wyatt were sharing.
Amazing. Well, look, I think one of the most notable points, of course, is that, you know, what you've got is you've got a deliberate deception going on with tourists being steered in the totally the wrong direction. Yes. You know, it makes you think, well, actually somebody somewhere doesn't want the general public to know the truth about this, and they're actively, you know, sort of of course it could just simply be that somebody has got some real estate on a mountain somewhere and they've decided to try and make a tourist thing out of nothing. But anyway, look, also I know one of the things that Jonathan looks into in quite a lot of depth is this whole idea of the lost secrets of the ancients. Now, this is one of those favourite things of conspiracy theorists where they say, well, actually, you know what? Back thousands of years ago, people had an enormous amount of knowledge that was then lost, and it's been kept from us, you know, such as the so-called discovery of electricity back in the 1800s. Well, actually, maybe the ancients had some knowledge of this sort of thing as well. So this is another film he made, The Lost Secrets of the Ancients.
Yes, exactly. There's a lot of evidence that in the past, technology in certain areas reached at least where we're at, in some cases, maybe even beyond, we don't know. Like you say, electricity, for example. There's the famous Baghdad battery that was found in the ruins of Baghdad, which when it was found in the 1800s, they didn't perhaps understand it. But now when you look at it, you realize, hey, this is a battery. It's got a anode, a cathode. You know, you can see, and they work out how many volts it could have produced if you put the right electrolyte into it. What were they doing with these batteries? What were they doing with the electricity produced? There's other mysteries too, like, you know, some of the tunnels and the chambers, the passageways and the pyramids. There's no evidence of smoke in there, you know. How did they light them to do the tunneling? And there's even Egyptian hieroglyphs which show interesting things like, looks like large electric light bulbs. There's a famous hieroglyph that shows this, looks like a tube. It looks like an electrical diagram, you know, with insulators, braided cables, and this large clear bulb, if you like, with it has a depiction of a snake in it, and then another depiction of a priest holding something near it, and it deflects the beam, or deflects the snake as it's depicted in the hieroglyphs. So it's highly likely that there was knowledge probably held by the elites of the day, to help them maintain power, perhaps. When I say power, I mean, you know, control, or the awe of the general public, the population. And so it wasn't possibly like our culture where everybody was using high technology, but it was held by a small group of the elite, you know, the priests or whatever. You know, there's examples in Egypt of stonework. And in fact, all around the world, there's amazing stonework where these stone blocks have been, well, they're supposedly carved to ultra precision. Whether they were carved or they had some stone softening technology or it was highly advanced cement, hard to say. But even in Egypt itself, you can see where the stone quarries were. They were obviously using some technology which we don't understand. The traditional or conventional understanding of how the Egyptians carved, like the big obelisks they carved, was with stone tools or copper tools. And yet people trying to reproduce that kind of method have got nowhere. Whereas you look at the abandoned obelisk in Egypt, you know, where they found one that was like weighed about 1,100 tons. They estimated if it had been removed. They were halfway through carving this obelisk out of the quarry and it developed a crack, so it was abandoned. But if you look at how they were carving it out, it looks like they were using either some sort of machinery or some technology we don't know, because the gouges where they're carving away this obelisk out of the stone, it looks like nothing that we understand today. And if you say, well, this is done with stone tools or copper tools, it's ridiculous. Even some of the items found in the Cairo Museum, there's such precision on it, and it's been machined. You know, they found slabs of stone that have been abandoned that have holes drilled in them. Clearly they were using lathes. Some of the stone vases are carved with such precision, you realise this is done on a lathe.
Well, look, you know, this is all to do with technology, isn't it? And I think that's quite clear, isn't it, through the ages, that technology has been, I mean, even if you go and have a look at, say, the replacement of horses in agriculture with tractors, basic stuff like this, it's who owns and controls that technology that really counts. And those, are, you know, the people who are actually doing the work very rarely actually own their own technology, you know, so that it's the owners of the technology that win. I mean, you could almost make a Luddite out of me saying, well, we don't really want this technology unless it's something which the, you know, the productivity can be shared around a bit rather than it's all taken by the people that own it. So this technology is a very powerful thing.
Yes, absolutely. And clearly in the past, there has been very high technology. Even like some of the temples in India indicate high technology of the past. You know, we're going back a couple of thousand years. Technology which we thought was only invented in the last couple of hundred years. There's depictions of people riding bicycles in temples that are a couple of thousand years old in India. You know, there's other things which we look at and we don't understand it. There's some carvings that look like somebody's holding a tablet or a cell phone, you know, and tapping your finger on it.
Well, look, I mean, you're going a little bit Eric von Daniken or whatever on us now, or the chariots of the gods, that actually, you know, there's this secret thing with aliens. But look, let's just stick to the Bible. Sir, the Ark of the Covenant, maybe we can finish by looking at that. That's one of the longer films, Searching for the Ark of the Covenant by Jonathan Gray, another one of his surprising discoveries.
Yes, well, that's a very, very interesting area. And of course, probably the most, you know, when I share these things, that's the most controversial discovery that Ron White worked on and Jonathan Gray shared. Jonathan wrote a book on it called The Ark of the Covenant. And I've done a lot of research on this. I've actually visited the Israeli antiquities and spoken to people. And that's a very interesting story I could tell you on its own. Because here's the thing. If you approach the Israeli antiquities, this is how it used to be anyway, and ask about this discovery, ask about Ron Wyatt, you'll get a standard denial letter. But in speaking with certain individuals within the antiquities department, you get quite a different story. I'll tell you a little story. I had an experience I had myself. This is firsthand. If this discovery is there, there would be a tunnel leading from underneath the city of Jerusalem from a quarry called Zedekiah's Cave. Are you familiar with that? Zedekiah's Cave. Anyway, on the north side of Jerusalem, there's this quarry. And if the Ark of the Covenant discovery is true, there's a tunnel leading from that quarry to the north of Jerusalem, about maybe about 140 meters long. And we thought, this is myself and an American friend, we thought, let's go and see if we can confirm that detail by scanning the ground between the north side of Jerusalem and where the Ark of the Covenant would be hidden if it's there. And we approached the Antiquities Department. And, well, I'll tell you a little embarrassing story. We're sitting in the office of the head archaeologist for Jerusalem at the time. I could give you his name, but maybe I shouldn't, because you might get phone calls. And we explained what we wanted to do. And he said, okay, are you archaeologists, are you? And we had to say, no, we're not archaeologists. He said, okay, you work for a university. And we had to say, no, we don't work for a university. And he said to us, well, look, sorry, you can't just come to Israel and do that kind of work here unless you're qualified or working for a university. And we thought, oh, well, nice try. This is what I was thinking in my mind. At least we tried. We got nowhere. But before we about to get up and leave, the other archaeologist who was there, and I can give you his name as well, out of the blue said, did you know Ron Wyatt, did you? Now, we hadn't mentioned Ron Wyatt. We hadn't mentioned the Ark of the Covenant. All we were saying is we would like to scan the road in that area because we believe there could be a tunnel there. That's all we had said. And when I said yes, I did know Ron Wyatt, and I stayed in his home. I knew him personally. They said, okay, in that case, you tell us what you'd like to do, and we'll arrange it for you. It'll be under our umbrella. And they even wrote to the Garden Tomb Authority, because part of the scanning would have been in their land. The IAA, the Antiquities Authority, wrote to the Garden Tomb asking them to give us permission to do this scan. So the thing is, if you talk to the right people, even though there might be official denials at the official level, there are people within the Antiquities Department who have actually bent over backwards to further research this and looking for help outside. There's another bit of a story as to why they want outside help to do this. And I don't know how deep you want to dive into this rabbit hole, but there's some very interesting experiences in the past history to do with this. To keep this biblical for now, let me share this thought with you. What Ron Wyatt claimed and what Jonathan wrote in his book is quite radical. I guess you may be familiar with this. And the whole scenario is not just about the Ark of the Covenant having been hidden in a cave back in the days of Jeremiah, because the scenario is this. About 600 BC, give or take a little bit, when the Babylonians were coming to invade Jerusalem, the Ark of the Covenant was hidden by men in Jerusalem. You know, there's different theories. Did it go to Ethiopia? Did it go to somewhere in Egypt? There's even legends that went to Ireland, you know, that sort of thing. But the scenario is, and this ties up with the Apocrypha, which is not part of the Bible, but it has some history in there. It was hidden in a cave about the time of the Babylonian invasion by men in Jeremiah's day. And what Ron Wyatt discovered, this is the amazing thing, is that when Jesus was crucified on the cross, the Bible says, it's in Matthew 28, I could give you the reference if you like, it says, the earth did quake and the rocks were rent. And shortly after that, the soldier thrust the spear into Jesus' side, it says in John chapter 19, and out came blood and water. Now, that blood and water flowed down the crack that the earthquake had created at the foot of the cross, down into the cave where the Ark of the Covenant had been hidden, secreted away, nearly 600 years before, and landed on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. That's what Ron Wyatt shared as his discovery. That's what he found had happened beneath the Calvary escarpment. When he discovered the Ark of the Covenant, he found dried up blood on it. And when he had it analyzed, it was human blood, but unique human blood. Human blood belonging to a person that had no earthly father. All the genetic material from the mother was there, but on the male side, the father's side, there was only the chromosome to determine that the child would be a male. Nothing else. So this was a non-human father. And that, of course, fits the Bible where it says a virgin would conceive. Now, when I first heard about this, I thought, wow, that's a bit far out there. when I got to know Jonathan and listened to him share this, I did a lot more study saying, does this work theologically? Does it make sense that the blood of Jesus would go down and land on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant? And I can tell you, after doing close to 25 years of study on this, it fits perfectly in two areas. There's two aspects that I share that this discovery fits to a T. And if you've got a little moment, I can explain both of those. Would you like to hear the two theological aspects that I believe this discovery...
Well, I think it's fascinating that you're able to take on some of Jonathan's work. Please go for it, yeah.
Okay. I'll give you the two, shall we say, biblical confirmations of this discovery. One is that when the old covenant was formed, you know how God led the children of Israel out of Egypt to Mount Sinai, and he came down on the mountain and spoke his Ten Commandments. You know, the old Ten Commandments movie depicting that. It's a story straight out of the Bible. And then the covenant, what we call the old covenant, was ratified between God and Israel. You know, we call it the old covenant. This is the covenant that the Israelites were under. And if you look at the ceremony that Moses did to ratify that covenant, in that ceremony, he took blood and water and he sprinkled what was called the Book of the Covenant. Now, that was a foreshadowing. That was a type. You know, in the Bible, they talk about types, the typology, where the Old Covenant symbols pointed to the reality. For example, the lamb that was slain day by day in the Old Covenant temple symbolized Jesus. He was the anti-type. Well, if you look at what was the anti-type of what Moses accomplished, what he did in that ratification ceremony, the anti-type meant that the law of the covenant had to be sprinkled with the blood and water. And so how was God's law sprinkled with blood and water in the new covenant when Jesus died, except it be that the blood and water went down that crack and landed over the law that was still inside the Ark of the Covenant? That was God's law. After he'd spoken it from Mount Sinai, he wrote it on tables of stone. And you read in Jeremiah that the new covenant, he says, would be, he will put my law in their inward parts. This is God speaking. I will write my law in their inward parts. So when Jesus died and the soldier thrust a spear in, the blood and water went down the crack opened by that earthquake and landed on the Ark of the Covenant beneath the cross and ratified God's law as the law of the new covenant. Now, the other biblical aspect that fits this to a T is what the Jews did on the Day of Atonement. You know, the high priest of the Jews, every year, once a year on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, put blood on top of the Ark of the Covenant. That was part of the Day of Atonement ceremony. And if you look at the types, why, after the priest had killed what was called the Lord's goat, they had a selection process between two goats. One became the Lord's goat, and that was slain, and its blood was sprinkled on the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. He would go into the most holy place with this blood and sprinkle it on the Ark. It's the only time of the year that he went in there. Now, that was done as part of the process of the cleansing of the sanctuary, cleansing the record of the sins of Israel. And by sprinkling blood on the Ark of the Covenant over the law, that was like saying to the law, here you are, the price has been paid. This is the evidence that the guilty party has forfeited their life, and you do that by sprinkling the blood of the sacrifice over the law. Now, that was foreshadowing, of course, what would happen with Jesus when the Messiah would come. Jesus was the true sacrifice. That goat on the Day of Atonement symbolized Jesus. And so when Jesus died on the cross to pay the price for our sins, according to the type, what had to happen? his blood had to be sprinkled over the law. And again, that fits exactly what happened, according to Ron White's discovery. The blood going down the crack and landing on the Ark of the Covenant over the law to show the law that the price had been paid. The guilty party, our substitute Jesus, had been killed and his blood had been shed. And so those two types, the ratifying of the covenant and the blood sprinkled on the mercy seat on the Day of Atonement, both of those indicated that Jesus' blood had to go down onto the Ark of the Covenant. And so, if you like, that's a biblical confirmation that the Ark of the Covenant was hidden there under the Calvary escarpment back in the days of Jeremiah.
It certainly could be. I bet you the Pharisees and the Sadducees weren't expecting that when they arranged for him to be crucified. And if they'd known about it at the time, I think if I remember rightly, there was also supposed to be an eclipse or something at the same time. You're talking about an earthquake when all that happened. And I think it's quite clear that at the time, when Jesus was crucified, the establishment kind of got the collywobbles a little bit. They were, crikey, you know, we've got an earthquake, we've got an eclipse, we've got the temple, the veil being ripped in two, and all this sort of stuff going on. And so there was a sign, you know, this is, I think, you know, you're quite right, this is the way God works, you know, that when people upset the natural order of things or the proper order of things, then God makes his presence felt in various ways. And you've done a fantastic job there, I think, Ross, but of adding to some of Jonathan's work. And this, do you want to just say a little bit more about this chap Ron Wire, what happened to him? Because I think it's wonderful that what Jonathan's done is kind of reinforced in a way the discoveries he was kind of doing as a kind of lone wolf.
Yes, very much. Ron Wire was a tremendous pioneer. He a very thinking outside the box sort of guy, and that's what, you know, led him to these sites. And when he was asked in meetings, we organized meetings for him as well, you know, how could one man find all these things? And he said, well, one man couldn't. He believed God was leading him providentially to these things. And we're extremely grateful here for what Jonathan did, because Ron White wasn't, well, he wasn't really on the radar much, if you want to call it that. He wasn't, shall we say, very skilled at sharing his discoveries.
Look, hang on a second, because I mean, I think you're absolutely right. What seemed to happen in the UK anyway, when I was a youngster, was this story about the Ark sort of popped up and then it all kind of disappeared, and there seemed to be an instant, you know, move by the mainstream press to suppress what he was up to.
Yes, I've heard that there are a couple of news reports. I knew a lady from Sweden that she read a newspaper article or a little clip in the newspaper that the Ark of the Covenant had been discovered, and then it disappeared, gone, and disappeared off everyone's radar. And then it was Jonathan Gray, particularly in Australia and New Zealand, who did a lecture tour circuit, you know, around the islands, around Australia, around New Zealand, and the UK. A good friend of mine, Aaron Sen, was became a Christian because he went to a Jonathan Gray meeting back in the 90s. You know, so Jonathan did a wonderful work in drawing attention to these things, which, and presenting them really well and giving a lot of the background to people that might have only heard them in passing years before and not given it much serious thought. So, and the fact that Jonathan went to these sites himself and what he shared was his own experiences, you know, his own experiences looking at the Red Sea, his own experience going to Sodom and Gomorrah, his own experiences in Turkey and the close shaves that he had researching Noah's Ark, you know, drew a lot of public interest.
And okay, so Ali, my final question to you is, what's going on? I mean, if these there is you know, evidence backing, as it certainly appears, to Ron White's work and Jonathan Gray's work, how come it seems to be being so actively suppressed? I mean, the mainstream press don't seem to be interested whatsoever in something which is actually amazing, fantastic news.
Well, if I can share an analogy, I know exactly what you're saying, and this is exactly what we find. You know, these are significant things, and they're there. They can go and be investigated, but it's sort of like the silence is deafening from the mainstream media. Or when they do get reported, they get reported in a cynical, sarcastic way, you know. And the analogy I would put to you is this. When Jesus came 2,000 years ago, he was the truth. He was the reality. This was the Messiah that Israel had been waiting for so long. But he wasn't exactly what they wanted. They wanted a warrior king to come in with an army on a white horse, you know, and get rid of the Romans. Jesus was teaching like the Sermon on the Mount. You know, what are the qualifications for being a subject of the kingdom that he was setting up? You know, it wasn't, we're going to get rid of the Romans. It was, you need your hearts changed. And so the establishment rejected him because he wasn't what they wanted. Yet nevertheless, he was the truth. He was the reality. And so Jesus was followed faithfully by a small group of people, the disciples, and crowds came out to hear him. But when he was crucified on a cross, how many people were there? Very, very few, you know. And truth is often that way. Truth is often ignored by the mainstream or even ridiculed, you know. The establishment of Jesus' day went out of their way to try to discredit Jesus. They called him that deceiver, you know. The sad tragedy of the New Testament wasn't that a deception came along and deceived Israel, but rather the truth came. Here was the Messiah, and they labeled him a deceiver. They called the truth falsehood. And isn't that what we see today? With so much, there's a mainstream narrative, and often the truth is ignored or ridiculed or buried under rubbish. We know there is a lot of falsehood around today, but if you dig deep, the truth is there, and the truth can stand up to close investigation. I've been to the Middle East myself about 15, 16 times now investigating these sites, and it's all there. It's there to be researched and discovered. And there are now other ministries, there's other groups you can get on YouTube, and there's a lot of different groups have done their homework, shall we say, stepped outside the box of the mainstream narrative and gone and proven, yes, these sites are there. There are sulfur balls there. There are shapes in the air.
We've got thousands of universities around the world and history departments and theology colleges. They don't seem to be interested.
Well, maybe it's the implications that they've been bypassed. I mean, I'll share this. When I was living in Australia myself, Melbourne, we organized meetings there for Ron Wyatt and Jonathan Gray. A friend of mine who was a doctor, very well-qualified man, he decided to write a book against these things. And we spent hours going over the evidence with him, saying, look, here's the evidence. And yet it's like he didn't want to know. I guess the attitude is, if God was going to reveal anything significant, he would use qualified people like me to do it, you know. But, you know, back in Jesus' day, who was it that the angels announced the birth of Jesus to? Did the angels go to Jerusalem and sing over the city of Jerusalem, over the temple, you know, the Messiah is born? No, they visited shepherds out in the hills of Bethlehem, you know, and that was probably insulting to the leaders of Jerusalem to think, why would God announce the birth of the Messiah to a bunch of farm workers and bypass us? We're the scholars and the theologians. And on that basis, they wouldn't even go to Bethlehem to check whether these things were true. They knew the Messiah was to be born in Bethlehem, but they didn't even go there.
There are two levels to this, I think, aren't there? There's first of all the people that don't want to see and don't want to look, and then there is the active deception as well, which, you know, we've been talking about a bit here. Actually, the book of Matthew you mentioned there, I mean, it also talks about Jesus's resurrection, saying that that there was a story. The authorities at the time said, well, hang on a minute, these Jesus's followers, what they might do is steal his body and say that he's been resurrected. And so they actually put an armed guard outside the tomb with the stone in the way, in order to try to stop that happening. But of course, you know, it happened anyway. And apparently the word was put around, oh, what happened was Jesus's disciples actually stole the body. So, you know, don't believe any of this stuff about him being resurrected. So there's a deception been going on all the time. But anyway, look, that was absolutely fascinating chatting to you, Ross. Do you want to just say, you know, whereabouts people can go to, I mean, either physically in person, if anywhere, or else online to, you know, to pick up on some of this and to follow it up?
Yes, there are a number of websites where material's available. That one that you mentioned before, you found.
Well, we've got a couple, haven't we? We've got beforeus.org, which is how I got hold of you originally. Beforeus.org, which is that's actually Jonathan Gray's sort of legacy site. Then we've got another one called The Third Watch Ministries, with many of his YouTube films on there, the ones we've mentioned, plus quite a few more.
Yes. There's a number of folks in the States who also support this work very much. There is arcdiscovery.com, run by Kevin Fisher. There's anchorstone.com, run by Jerry Bowen, who's also a researcher in these things. I have a website which I'm working on as we continue to do what we can on the Noah's Ark site. It's called arcdig.com. That's a website under development. And there's a contact page there if anyone wants to get in touch. And we've been working with the government to excavate the Noah's Ark site, because at the end of the day, we want to know, is this Noah's Ark or not? Ron Wyatt and Jonathan Gray did a lot of research. Ron did core drillings. He did radar scans. We've done our own radar scans too, by the way. And last year, we applied to do excavations. We managed to excavate in a village nearby, which was connected to that, where the anchor stones are. And we have some details on that. So there's a contact page on arcdig.com if anyone would like to ask any questions. So hopefully that's some avenues so people can chase up some resources.
Yeah, it certainly is. And I think, you know, you said it yourself, it certainly ain't no fairy story, this, which is what most of the mainstream media journalists and as a member of the Journalist Union, I don't think the journalists really are to blame. I think it's almost all actually the owners of these transmitters, the people that actually own the transmitter, the people that own the printing presses. They are not the journalists. They are the private equity firms. They are the hedge funds. They are the banks. And these and the editors that they employ are the real people who are really responsible. There's thousands, tens of thousands of journalists I know out there who would love to get their teeth into stories like this if they're only given half a chance. So, Ross Patterson from Waikato in New Zealand, thanks ever so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.